Welcome to Are You Quizzing Me? I'm Vineet Nair with my co-host Aditya Kashyap. This is a quizzing trivia podcast show. Join us as we dive deep into history, science, sport, pop culture, and so much more. Let's get quizzing.
And we're back for episode number 40 of Are You Quizzing Me? Your favorite quizzing podcast show. As usual, let's start off with an audience question before moving to our regularly scheduled programming. This audience question is specifically for you, our dear audience. We will be revealing the answer to this question at the end of the episode, so you have roughly 30-40 minutes to figure out the answer to this. No Googling. So the answer to the question for you this week is, the Chinese gooseberry is the edible berry of several species of woody vines in the genus Actinidia. It's native to central and eastern China. In the first recorded description dates back to the 12th century during the Song Dynasty. In the early 20th century, cultivation of the Chinese gooseberry spread to another nation, which gave it a name from its indigenous language. And this is the name by which we know it today. It soon became popular with Allied servicemen stationed in that country during World War II, which soon led to increased demand after the war and consequently its cultivation all throughout the world. How do we better know the Chinese gooseberry? Now, moving on to our oldest tradition, something which we've maintained without fail for 40 episodes, Aditya's question, though calling it a question would be somewhat of a loose description, but you know what we're talking about. So, Aditya, what was your question from last week? And what is your quote-unquote answer?
Vineet, I know that you deride my answers and questions every week, yet today I would be very surprised if you do not agree with me on my answer. The question that was posed last week was, which actor has played the same role multiple times and has not been recognized with an award for it yet? An Oscar, specifically. And this was in the context of actors who have received Oscars for playing the same character in multiple movies. So, my question stood, and the answer goes, Ranbir Kapoor. You know what? I have a very specific thing about Ranbir Kapoor, and he has played the exact same character in multiple movies where there's this grown man-child who's just refusing to come of age, and then some manic pixie character comes into his life and suddenly grows up. But that's not even the biggest thing that is similar across all his films. There is a scene, there is an iconic scene that is the same in at least three of his movies. Ranbir Kapoor at a wedding of someone he loves or loved in the past, and then turning around and walking away.
Yes, with his eyes glistening with tears. I agree with you completely.
With eyes glistening with tears. This is in Bachna Hai Haseeno in the song Jogi Mahi. This is also there in Ye Jawani Hai Diwani. And it is also there in Ae Dil Hai Mushkil. All three movies where, for some reason, Ranbir Kapoor has a backpack on or is walking away from the wedding with this sad, happy face and leaving behind his love to move on in life, I guess. I don't know. And it's just the same exact scene. I can't believe that he has done the same exact scene in multiple movies. It is.
I agree with you completely.
I think the consistency should be.
I agree with you completely. The characters are indistinguishable.
I don't know if you agree with the part that he should be given an award. Yes, they are all the same. They're all the same characters. And I don't know if you agree with the part that he should be given an Oscar for this. But he has played the same character in multiple movies. That part is very
Maybe the category could be the best consistency shown by an actor across movies.
Yeah, that is probably.
And it's also, let me just put this out there. Do you know that this has actually also been copied?
Oh, I had no idea.
Yes, it has. So if many people remember, if you watch Sherlock, Benedict Cumberbatch very famously copied the same kind of scene where he walks away from Watson's wedding into the night, putting on his coat, which I believe is a direct reference to and tribute to the great Ranbir Kapoor.
Let us just put it out there into the ether that Benedict Cumberbatch is paying homage to Ranbir Kapoor's characters in that iconic.
Yes, Stephen Moffat, you have some explaining to do.
Okay. How about we move on to some actual trivia?
Enough of these shenanigans. Why don't you start us off for this week, Aditya, with your question?
Okay, so my first question today is actually an audience question. And this is a quick point for me to also make to any listener out there. Hey, if you like listening to our show and would like to contribute a question, please do send us one on our social media or on our email. We would love to receive one, and we would absolutely love to have it as a question in our future episodes. This one is from one of our regular listeners, Anirudh, who's also a dear friend. Anirudh told me that he recently hosted a quiz himself, and he also used some of our questions. Specifically, he used the question about Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical company, and they broadcasted an event to the entire country when everybody rejoiced. This is in America. This was a question Vineet asked a couple of episodes ago. So Anirudh used this in his quiz. And the answer, if you're wondering, you'll have to go find that episode and listen to that episode. But he also gave me a lovely question that he suggested I could ask in the next episode, so I shall. Now, this question is from Science and Technology. And it goes, in 1997, Gordon Moore, Intel's co-founder, saw an AMD processor in a computer and offered to upgrade that specific computer to a quote-unquote real computer with an Intel processor. Ever since then, a dedicated team at Intel has upgraded this computer every 2 years. Which computer am I talking about?
So 1997, Intel engineer offers to upgrade a computer which had an AMD processor, right? And
Intel co-founder, okay. Gordon Moore, very famous individual, after whom Moore's Law is named.
He's pretty big. It's a big name. Okay, so he offers to upgrade a computer, and he then continues to do so every 2 years. I'm guessing with Intel hardware.
Yes, because it was an AMD processor, he offered to make it a quote-unquote real computer, tongue-in-cheek way of saying that, hey, listen, use an Intel processor, not an AMD processor. And subsequently, every 2 years, Intel would actually upgrade that computer to whatever the latest specifications were.
So this would be a this is a specific computer you're talking about, a specific unit, not like a brand or a line of computers, right? It's a specific unit somewhere located. No. So I have no clue, but I think I know where the direction of this thing is going. So does it have to do anything with the U.S. government? Is it like a computer at the White House?
No, it does not.
Or at NORAD or something? No.
No, it does not. Since you mentioned that, this question does have some more clues. So let me give you some clues. This computer, some very famous people have interacted with this computer as well. Some of the greatest minds, world leaders, scientists, even some actors have interacted with this specific computer.
Wait, is this IBM's Deep Blue?
No, this is not IBM's Deep Blue. Let me go ahead with another clue. Since March 2018, this computer has not been used.
Okay, is this a computer NASA?
No. And okay, now I'm going to give you the last part of this question, which Anirudh had put in the main question. So to be fair to you, Anirudh's question had a lot more clues in it. I have
divided
it up so to make it more interesting.
Be dastardly about it.
Yes. Indeed. So the last clue that Anirudh had put in his question goes, to control the computer, an optical sensor would track movements of the user's cheek muscle below the right eye and relay that to a SwiftKey predictive keyboard.
This is Stephen Hawking's text-to-speech, it tracks his eye and allows him to speak in that weird robotic voice. That's the thing, right?
You should take full credit for getting this answer, because technically his whole question had this in the first place. I just omitted it for... intrigue. Yes, you did get it. Yes, it is Stephen Hawking's computer. Sadly, since March 2018, it has not been used, because that's when Stephen Hawking passed away. As I mentioned, a lot of people have interacted with Stephen Hawking through this computer, and some actors including those from Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, Sheldon famously had a fainting episode in front of Stephen Hawking, if I remember correctly.
That's the one, yeah. This was a computer that Gordon Moore, who's Intel's co-founder, offered to upgrade back in 1997. And since then, every 2 years, they did do so. Interestingly enough, Moore's Law that I mentioned earlier says that the processors the number of transistors in an integrated circuit will double every 2 years. So I wonder if the 2-year thing is just something that they do at Intel. Like, they just do upgrades every 2 years because Moore said that that's how often it should happen.
But is that law, is it still doubling every 2 years? I think it's stalled, right now? Because
it is not really a law of physics as such. It is more of an empirical relationship. And when he predicted it, he said it only for the next 10 years. I think he did it in 1965, and he predicted it for the next 10 years. So he wasn't making some prophecy for eternity. And it has gotten a bit low. Since 2010, apparently, it has reduced. The pace has reduced slightly. But it is still increasing.
We'd probably have to move from binary to quantum computing to be able to get back to that. But there, I think the spike would be quite high. It'd be more of a sigmoid curve.
Oof, fancy, fancy terms, Vineet. Fancy terms.
I'm not the engineer here.
But you're right, yes. And yet, I am the one who's saying that you are really throwing some jargon at me, which is going over my head right now.
So it's my turn for the question, and this is mine. There are, as of now, 2,763 stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Only one star out of the 2,763 is set on a vertical surface, that it's not on the floor or on the pavement where all the stars usually are. There's only one out of these 2,763, which is on a vertical surface, and it's on the wall of the Dolby Theater. Okay. My question is, whose Hollywood star on the Walk of Fame is set on a vertical surface?
I do know this trivia. This is, if I'm not wrong, this is Muhammad Ali.
Yes, it is Muhammad Ali. Oh, this was too easy. I should have gone to something harder. But yes, this is Muhammad Ali. He did not want his star on the floor for two reasons. One, he didn't want people stepping on the name Muhammad. And number two, he didn't want people who didn't respect him stepping all over his name.
Ah, okay. Interesting. I knew the first reason. I didn't know the second one. Okay.
Yeah. So that's... you got that way too quickly. Yeah, so that was my question. So let's move on very quickly to your question.
It is just one of those pieces of trivia which is something that sticks with you once you read it. But yeah, lovely, lovely question. Thanks for asking that, Vineet. Okay.
You know, we have gotten comments that we are very formal.
I hated that question, Vineet. Worst question ever.
I'm leaving that in, by the way.
Okay, for those of our listeners who think that we are too nice to each other, we shall rip each other apart once in a while. That's what the world wants to see. Just wants to see things burn. Okay. So my question is, the National Science Museum back in 1998 featured a sweater, a jumper. Why would the National Science Museum feature a jumper? Is a very simple question, which might not be the easiest to crack given the bare minimum information I've given so far. But in case you already know this trivia, I want you to have the opportunity to crack it immediately.
I do not know this piece of trivia. There's a jumper. So this is, I'm guessing because you use the word jumper that this is the UK.
Oh, no, it's a sweater. I just said jumper, sweater, but it is a sweater.
Okay, okay. Okay.
This is the US.
This is the US. Okay, fair enough. So I am going to guess that this, because you said jumper, I'm guessing this belonged to somebody really famous. And the only person I can think of... off the top of my head, who's famous for wearing a jumper is, or sweater or cardigan or whatever you want to call it, is Mr. Roger from the TV show for kids. Is it one of his jumpers?
Oh, no. That's a pretty decent guess, but no. And this is not on the right track. So let me try to bring you back to the right direction. This was designed by a 12-year-old girl. Her name was Holly Wharton. Holly designed a brightly colored sweater and won a nationwide contest with a blue, green, and white image depicting two identical sheep grazing in a field.
Okay, so that throws my next guess out the window, which was going to be Jacqueline Kennedy's bloodstained Chanel coat, which I think could...
Remember, it's the National Science Museum.
Science Museum. So it's a bright blue jumper, or You've put that word in my head. Now I can only imagine jumpers. Okay, so it's a bright blue jumper with two sheep, identical sheep grazing, and somebody designed this. A 12-year-old girl yes. designed this.
It was part of a contest, a nationwide contest, and she won it. And eventually, this sweater was then featured in the National Science Museum.
Okay, now so usually, let me just try to work this out. Usually contests are held when they want to create something for a particular event or something of that sort, right? Or to commemorate something, obviously. So this it's not like this jumper's been to space or anything, right?
No.
No.
But it is significant in the field of science.
A jumper that's significant to the field of science and two identical sheep, is there anything else in that jumper that you're not talking about, say an apple tree?
They're grazing in a field.
Okay.
There is no apple tree.
There is no, because I was thinking of Newton and maybe something to do with Newton. Why would they have a sweater in a science museum? Two sheep. There is no such thing as Schrodinger's sheep, is there?
No.
Because I was wondering, if you have one sheep in front and the other sheep behind, you don't know if there's a sheep behind unless you go and look.
This sounds like when you know when you're in school and they tell you that the Ashoka statue, the symbol, it has four lions. You just can't see the fourth lion because it's hidden behind. Yeah. And it blew my mind the first time I realized it. I was like, whoa, there are not three but four. Sounds exactly like that.
Okay. So let's move away from Schrodinger's sheep.
Yeah.
I'll need another clue.
Holly Wotton, who was the designer of this thing, the 12-year-old girl, when she was presenting it at the museum, she was accompanied by an actress, Jenny Agutter.
Jenny Agutter?
Agutter, my bad. Agutter, yes. Jenny Agutter, who is a carrier of the hereditary disease cystic fibrosis.
Okay.
Agutter's interest in this particular scientific, let's call it, achievement was the fact that someday the technology that came from it could help cure the disease or find solutions for the disease and for people who suffer from it.
Did you by any chance tell me which year this jumper went on view?
Yes, this is 1998.
This is the cloning of Dolly?
This is the wool from Dolly. You are right.
Okay,
yes.
They use the wool from Dolly to make the jumper. Okay, yes.
Sweater made from the wool of Dolly. And they held a contest, nationwide contest to design it. And which is why I mentioned it is a blue, green and white image depicting two identical sheep grazing in a field.
Okay. I did not catch that the first time round. But then when you... Because it is my fault because I kept thinking in the 60s. The National Science Museum, because my mind went to the 60s, which is why I was thinking, has it gone to space in the Apollo space program? Is it something to do with Kennedy's assassination? So all my thoughts were way back and suddenly hit me. Is it the 90s?
Well, that was a very good crack. For anybody who might not be aware, Dolly was a sheep which was created from the udder of an adult sheep and was the first mammal to be cloned in that particular way. Dolly was the first proof of concept of cloning in the animal world. And hence it could also, as was assumed, that it could one day help find cures for diseases like cystic fibrosis. And that's how they commemorated Dolly's wool, by creating a sweater from it.
I wonder what happened to the... Like, this is a very morbid thought and not something I should be thinking. But, you know, these are the kind of thoughts that pass through my head. I wonder, like, after Dolly died, or did they kill her? If she did die, what did they do with the body? Basically, did Dolly end up as a rack of lamb on somebody's plate? Or a goat curry? Or
well,
a sheep curry?
I mean, that is a very morbid thought, Vineet. You know, this is like when you watch a movie and you think, oh, the dog in that movie is probably dead now. Because it has been 30 years since that movie came out. So that dog is definitely dead. Look at us, two morbid folks laughing at dead animals.
So, I am going to go to a little different format for a few questions this week. So, have you heard of misleading movie descriptions? So, this is something I went down a rabbit hole when I was, as usual, trawling the internet. So there are these descriptions of movies crafted by people much smarter than me, which give a semi-accurate picture of the movie itself, but maybe from a different point of view. Okay, so I will give you these descriptions. I will do it in sets of three, and you can let me know what movie this is from the description.
Okay.
Okay, so at first I'll give you the description, and for a clue, if you ask for a clue, I'll give you the year in which the movie was released, which should help you.
Okay.
So the first one, an army veteran learns about family values when he takes over his aging father's business.
Army vet, family values. Oh, Godfather.
Yes. Okay, you've got the hang of this very quickly. So I'll move on to the next one.
Okay.
A beautiful French woman hides a secret affair with a traitor and terrorist from her gay husband. She gets pregnant with the terrorist's baby and uses the fact to torture her father-in-law just before the terrorist gets executed in a very gruesome manner.
Oh, wow. Just, okay, because I've not seen this movie, so I don't know if this is the plot of the film. Is it Les Miserables?
No, it is not Les Miserables.
Okay. Oh, and sorry, what did he say about the execution? The father-in-law or something? What was that?
Yeah, so she gets pregnant with the terrorist's baby and uses that fact to torture the father-in-law just before the terrorist gets executed in a very gruesome manner.
Oof.
Do you want a clue?
Yeah, give me a clue.
Okay. Movie released in 1995.
95. Braveheart did not marry a French woman, did he?
No, I never said he married the French woman. I said that he had an affair with the French woman. And you're right. It is Braveheart.
It is Braveheart.
It is Braveheart. Sophie Marceau, a very beautiful French woman.
Okay.
This is a pretty easy one. I have a feeling you'll get this very quickly. An eclectic group of dreamers meets a poor little rich boy on a plane and try to change how he feels about losing his father.
Inception.
I guess, very good.
I love the description, poor little rich boy.
I mean, like, that is kind of, it is kind of apt when you think of Cillian Murphy.
It
is quite apt. I will save the next three for after your question. So Aditya, hit me with whatever you have. Hit me with your best shot.
Okay, that was fun. Well, since you did bring up film, I'm going to talk about Hollywood as well. And I'm going to name four characters. Tell me which 2004 film are they from. The names of these characters are Harry, Larry, Flo, and Mo.
Harry, Larry, Flo, and Mo.
Mm-hmm.
It's from a 2004 movie.
Yeah.
And these are the main characters, or have you just named some bit part characters along with the main character?
So technically, in the movie itself, they are never named. But these were the names given by their boss, who got really attached to them and decided to name them something because they didn't have a name to begin with.
What year did Despicable Me release? Are these names of minions or something?
No, this is not. This is not. That's a great guess, but no.
They're not named in the movie. 2004 film. Harry, Larry, Flo, and Mo. Are these human characters?
Ah, great question. They're not.
Okay, so they're not human. Four dogs, four robots, four cats. What could it be? What could it be? Do you have any other clues to give me?
So I mentioned that these characters first appeared in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
They also appeared again in 2021.
In 2021?
And both of these are massive hits. Both of these films were just very popular at the time of the release.
I am completely blanking on this. So a sequel after, 17 years?
So then this is not a sequel technically. It is part of the same lore, but it's not a direct sequel. Let me actually tell you more specifically. This is part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Or at least partially part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Okay. Let me geek out a little bit. So the first Marvel's, technically the first MCU movie would be Iron Man, but that was 2008. So you said 2004, which would make it a Marvel movie. Basically, it's from based on a Marvel product, what do you call it, property. It would be Marvel IP, mm-hmm. but produced by somebody else, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So in those days, New Line had Blade, which they released in 98. The others were Sony. The other characters were with Sony, which mm-hmm. were...
This is a Sony production.
So that makes it Spider-Man.
Correct. Who are these characters which are non-human? I'll give it to you. Spider-Man 2.
Spider-Man... Wait, are these Doc Ock's arms?
Yes, these are Doc Ock's arms.
Wow! Seriously? Larry...
Wow. Alfred Molina, the very iconic Doc Ock actor from Spider-Man 2, he was a little too attached to his tentacles and he gave them names. So he called them Harry, Larry, Flo, and Mo. And he used to distinguish them based on their strength and their dexterity. Harry and Larry were the lower extremities. They were bigger and heavier. Flo and Mo were slightly smaller but very powerful still. And Flo rested on Octavius's right shoulder and did all the delicate, intricate stuff, such as removing Dr. Octavius's glasses and lighting a cigar for him. Wow. So at some point, Alfred Molina got really attached to the tentacles and named them Harry, Larry, Flo, and Mo.
You know what's really surprising for me is I've seen the kind of behind the scenes for Spider-Man 2. And the way that they had their like multiple puppeteers with, you know, almost like puppet strings and things like that to animate or to move these particular, you know, arms, tentacles. So I wonder, was he actually calling the arms Harry, Larry, Flo, or Mo? Or was he, you know, very subtly and deceptively using those names for the puppeteers themselves?
A true actor does not see anything except what is in the scene with him. So he probably did not even care about the puppeteers. All he cared about were the tentacles. And
okay. No, that's a solid question. I had absolutely no plan. A lot of fun working that out. Oh, this is nice. That was a nice question. Okay. I see you. So I'm going to go back to my misleading movie descriptions. And this is a favorite one of mine because I partly made it up and I got part of it from the internet. So this is a favorite one of mine. A group of colorful characters have a workplace disagreement leading to an 87.5% mortality rate.
Reservoir Dogs.
Okay. Yes, you're right. It is Reservoir Dogs. How did you come to it? How did you get that so quickly? I was hoping I would have to give you at least the year for this one.
87.5. I was thinking 87.5. That means it has to be one in what? Nine people?
One in eight people survive.
Yeah. So the only thing which made sense. Initially, when you were saying workplace disagreement, I thought, oh, maybe some space film where something happens out in space. There are some very good films about that. But I don't know if you've watched Solaris.
Solaris, yes.
But it is a fantastic film. Oh no, sorry, my bad. Solaris is also a great film. I was talking about Sunshine. Sunshine is also a fantastic film.
Oh, Sunshine,
film.
Danny Boyle. My God, that's like the first good real space horror apart from Alien that I've seen.
And if you haven't watched this film, I would suggest just skipping ahead 30 seconds because I'm going to spoil it. There are massive disagreements there and everybody dies in that film. So I knew that was not 87.5% survival rate. Hence...
No, it's a fantastic film and I think quite underrated. It's not very popular or high up on most people's lists. But I love that movie. It's one of my favorite space horrors, even more than Event Horizon, which is just a bonkers movie. A lot of gore. It's like Hellraiser in space.
Fun movie.
Okay, so let me try and stump you with this. This actually, I have to give credit. This description is an actual description that came in a TV guide sometime in 97, 98, if I'm not mistaken. So it's an iconic description. A lot of people have heard about it because I can't remember the person's name who actually wrote it at the first time, but he's famous for having written this description. So keep in mind, this is an actual description which appeared in an actual TV guide in the late 90s. Okay. Transported to a surreal landscape, a young girl kills the first person she meets and then teams up with three strangers to kill again.
Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
Oh, I love that description. My mind immediately went to like something like Mad Max or something, but then Wizard of Oz, yes.
Okay, and this is also an easy one. I'll be very surprised if you don't get it very quickly. Just me hedging my bets here. Due to the voices in his head, a young man helps wanted terrorists kill thousands in a bid to seduce his sister.
Huh? What? That stumped me. He...
Okay.
Voices due to in the, his head?
Due to the voices in his head, a young man helps wanted terrorists kill thousands in a bid to seduce his sister.
Seduce his sister? Oh, and this is an iconic film.
Yeah, all of these are like, you know, movies you definitely know and definitely heard of.
The only one which is very iconic, which I can think of somebody trying to seduce his sister, is Gladiator. But there is no terrorist in that.
No.
A brother trying to seduce a sister. Ooh, that should not be a lot of films, I'd imagine.
You want a clue?
Yes. Wow.
Okay. So before giving, because I think the year would give it away too quickly, and you've been catching it to all of these too fast, so I'm going to give you another clue. At least at this point of time, he didn't know she was his sister. That's also a giveaway.
Oh, okay. Star Wars. Okay, that makes a lot more sense. All right.
Okay. One last one before we end up this set. This, again, is a description I heard on another podcast. It's called Let's Learn Everything. It's an amazing podcast. Listen to it. They basically spend 1.5 hours every week just giving you with a lot of knowledge. So this is something I heard on about that. I don't know where they got it, but this is where I heard it. And this is a paraphrasing. I'm not using their exact phrasing. There's slight changes to this. So this is how it goes. Partners protecting a senator split up after an assassination attempt. The older, wiser partner or mentor investigates the assassin, leading him to research libraries, CD bars, and secret government facilities. The younger, brash partner or mentee stays with the senator and, in a not unsurprising turn of events, commits a war crime.
Sounds like a very specific plot that I should remember if I've seen it.
I'd be surprised if you've not. I'm fairly sure you would have. Movie's a big deal. Like, it was a big deal when it came out. And it's within our lifetime, you know, Gen Y.
Throwback to previous episode. Okay. Two bodyguards, one of them investigates the assassination attempt, goes into the underbelly of the city. The other one ends up committing a war crime.
Yeah. The younger partner stays with the senator and in a not unsurprising turn of events, commits a war crime.
Is this Star Wars also? The prequels?
Which one?
The third one, right? Is it the Clone Wars or is it...
It is Attack of the Clones. Star Wars Episode 2, Attack of the Clones.
So
Senator Amidala, there's an assassination attempt against her. There's a very thrilling chase sequence through the skies. And in the end, the assassin is killed. Obi-Wan Kenobi goes searching for the assassin, finds the whole clone army and in a secret government facility. Anakin Skywalker stays with Padme to protect her, falls in love with her. When he visits Tatooine to visit his mother, he finds out that his mother has been killed by Bantha raiders. And so then he goes and wipes out an entire village, which technically is a war crime.
In my defense, the prequel movies have pretty much been suppressed in my mind. Like, I feel like I've forgotten most of them. So,
yeah, see, the thing is, there is a lot of trade agreements and things like that. But I would, I haven't seen Ahsoka. People have been telling me Ahsoka is really good. The new TV series, the one on Disney. But I would defend at least the first movie, The Phantom Menace.
You defend The Phantom Menace?
Yes, I will defend The Phantom Menace for the last 15 to 20 minutes because the last lightsaber fight between Darth Maul, Qui-Gon Jinn, and a very young Obi-Wan Kenobi as probably the best lightsaber fight in the entire, you know, 6 or 9 movies or whichever one you look at. Because the lightsaber duels in the last three movies which released, Ben Solo and whatnot, Yeah, not great. I mean, like, really, you should just watch them in slow motion. It's just horrible. But this fight, it is, I mean, like, it's a story. You can actually watch it, how, you know, the fight goes between Liam Neeson and Darth Maul, played by an amazing, fantastic Ray Park, a very acrobatic Ray Park. And then Qui-Gon Jinn is cut down, and then Kenobi just picks up. Then he goes from being the Padawan to the Master. And him cutting down Ray Park's Darth Maul and then becoming Anakin's Master is the transition point, the first transition point for Obi-Wan.
I agree. No, that is a fantastic scene. I would also recommend, because I recently saw this video where they were talking about film and music that is used in films.
Oh, yes.
Watching the same scene, and they use that as an example, watching that same scene without John Williams' score, it just feels like the soul of the scene has gone away.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, we can fact check this, but I think that particular theme is called Duel of the Fates.
But perhaps. But it is just a genius score, which elevates that scene so much beyond what it already is, a great scene. So I cannot fault you for loving that sequence. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the fight choreography in that is number one.
Yeah.
But to also be fair, that is the movie that introduced us to Jar Jar Binks.
Jar Jar Binks cannot be redeemed.
I mean, like, nobody can defend Jar Jar Binks, unfortunately.
Misa, agree. Okay. Let us do my last question for this episode.
Yes.
Okay. So, we are moving from Hollywood all the way to the UK and entertainment in the UK. Now, this particular idea for the show came to the creator Ian Messiter as he was riding on the top of a number 13 bus. He recalled Percival Parry Jones, a history master from his own days at Sherborne School. This particular master, when seeing the young Messiter daydreaming in a class, instructed him to do something very specific. Messiter realized that this would be a great idea for a show. Which show? Which iconic show in the UK am I talking about?
So it's an iconic TV show. On top of a number 13 bus, I think then 13 would be important for some reason.
Again, not very relevant. But it just
is a lot of red herrings. Lot of red herrings. Okay. So the only major clue I have is that this is something he was asked to do when he was daydreaming. And this is an iconic British show.
It's actually a panel show.
Oh, okay. So then let me start listing the panel shows on British television. This is what? 9 out of 10 Cats. Countdown.
No.
University Challenge.
No.
The Weakest Link.
Also, might I clarify, while this show has been adapted for TV, this was originally a radio show. I don't think I mentioned that, but this was originally a radio show. It was a BBC radio show.
A BBC radio show. But it has been
adapted for TV as well.
Yeah. It's been adapted for television. Mastermind. But no, that has its inspiration from the Gestapo interrogations during World War II. Not Mastermind. Then Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? But that's not a panel show. That's just a...
No.
Wow. Wait, is this QI?
This is not QI. I would have also guessed QI if I was posed this question. But no, not QI.
No, because I'm basically just at this point guessing panel shows, all the panel shows that I've seen on British television.
I don't know if this will help you, but the person who hosted it for almost 50 years, I believe, was this gentleman called Nicholas Parsons. It's a British individual.
Oh, why Nicholas is that Parsons. Name familiar?
He passed away in 2020.
That name is familiar. This is not Countdown, right?
This is not Countdown.
I would know the show, right? It's not like one of these obscure ITV shows that...
It has been running for more than 50 years. It has had some very iconic people who have appeared on it. Some of the people are Graham Norton, Sue Perkins, Stephen Fry. Names that you would...
To be fair, I don't think there's any panel show on which Stephen Fry has not appeared.
True, he's the BBC staple.
Do you have any other clues?
Okay. So let me tell you what happened in that iconic historic day where Messiter was a little boy in his school and he was daydreaming in class. His history master asked him to repeat everything that had just been said. But he gave him two restrictions. Now, Ian Messiter, when he adapted this for his show, he added a third restriction, and that has become the iconic, basically, format for this particular show. You might not be very well versed with the show, but once I say the name, it should ring a bell, I'd imagine.
Okay. Is it currently being hosted by a comedian?
It is hosted by Sue Perkins.
Sue Perkins is hosting the show? What show is Sue Perkins hosting? Nope, man, I think I spent too much. My mind is not going.
Let me just tell you what Percival Parry Jones, the history teacher, said. He said, repeat everything that has been said in the previous minute without hesitation or repetition. Messiter later also added the rule that you cannot deviate from the subject. So you have to talk
continuously
without hesitation,
for a minute,
repetition, and
without repeating yourself. We have versions of this in fests and competitions all across college.
That's how, yes. So this is actually how most people in India would know it. They might not know of the original show, but this happens in almost every fest in every college in India, the version of this. So you have your dumb charades, you have your plays, you have your dance competition, you also have this usually.
Yes, I know that. But now this is how numb my brain is. I cannot for the life of me remember, because I have participated in these things before. Granted, it was like 10, 15 years ago in school and whatnot, but I can't remember what this is. I can't remember what this is called.
To speak for a minute without hesitation, repetition, and deviation.
Yes, really. I know. And then people can challenge you in between, and then you got called out, and the person who ends the minute gets the points. I know the rules. Yes. I've played it before, but I can't remember what it is now. Oh, God. This is so stupid. I'm having a brain fart, man. I'm very sorry.
Okay, no. But I'll give it to you because you are obviously aware of what it is called. It's called Just a Minute. It's a jam.
Just a minute. Jam. Yes, it's jam. Okay. Oh, God. Yeah. I think my... This is just bad.
Don't be so hard on yourself.
This is just the worst moment on this podcast that I've had.
See, my gut instinct is to be nice to you, but then apparently our listeners want us to be rude to each other. So, Vineet... Shame, Vineet, shame.
You're missing a bell. You need a bell to go along with it. Doesn't have any effect.
Yes, we need a bell for this.
Okay. Oh, God. So, nice, man. I should have gotten that one. But chalo. Okay. I'll finish off today's set with a few more misleading movie descriptions. So here goes. Three failed college professors start a company where they threaten businesses for money, use their position to coerce dates, and destroy the environment.
What? Coerce dates and destroy the environment?
Destroy the environment. That's a major plot point.
No idea.
Oh.
I need a clue.
Okay. The year is 1984.
1980. Ghostbusters.
Yes, this is Ghostbusters. Yes.
You said three. There are four Ghostbusters, Vineet.
I said three college professors founded the company. True. The fourth one came in much later.
That is true. Okay. Yes, you are right. I am wrong.
A student uses a powerful device to do her homework, save her friend's pet, and an escaped convict.
Powerful device?
Yeah.
Do her homework, save her friend's pet, and help an escaped convict. Oof. Nope. No idea.
Okay, this is 2004.
Still blanking. It's my brain fart moment.
No, I'm just thinking of what kind of clue I could give for this. Okay, let's just say that the importance of the things that I've mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. I've mentioned homework, saving a friend, escaped convict. The importance of these particular acts, mm-hmm, to that person, to the student, is in the following order. Least important, escaped convict. Somewhat important, saving her friend's pet. Most important, doing her homework.
Okay.
At least I'm extrapolating. They don't mention this anywhere in the movie, but I'm extrapolating knowing the character.
Okay. Oh, this is Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yes, this is Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Okay.
And we're right. quoting Hermione Granger, who once said, "You might get killed, or worse, expelled."
Expelled. Lovely.
Yes. Okay. An orphan, torn between his home and heritage, realizes that he must condemn an entire race. Forced into an impossible choice, he commits genocide and then follows it up with a justifiable homicide.
No. Give me the year.
2013.
Oh. Is this a superhero film by any chance?
Yes.
This is... is this Superman? It's Man of Steel?
This is Man of Steel. Yes, yes, you have that. It is Man of Steel.
Okay.
Okay. A tragic tale of a father who goes to great extremes to save his son from an assassin obsessed with killing him. He ultimately fails and dies trying to get revenge.
Wait, the father dies or the son dies?
The father. Basically, I'll repeat the description again. A tragic tale of a father who goes to extremes to save his son from an assassin obsessed with killing him. He ultimately fails and dies trying to get revenge. Very tragic.
Trying to get revenge. This is not Lion King, right?
No.
No, I have no context right now. No clue.
Okay, this is 2014.
2014? Doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. This assassin is an extreme mass murderer in this movie.
The assassin is a mass murderer.
Yeah. Very high body count. And this father tries everything to save his son.
Is this John Wick?
Yes. Yes, this is John Wick.
Okay. Yep. Yep.
See it from the Russian's viewpoint. Man. He's desperately trying to save his son from this guy who's killing hundreds of people. Like, what is John Wick's body count till now?
John Wick is...
Spoiler alert for anybody who's not watched John Wick 4. But I like the fact that they ended the movie with him dying. Because there's no other way you could end John Wick's story. I mean, like, he can't keep killing people and then getting away with it and then finally living happily ever after. I mean, like, that's not possible. That was the only possible outcome.
Yeah, and it was a pretty great send-off also for a very iconic character.
So, this is the last one for this episode and for this particular set. A daughter disobeys her father and goes on a long sailing trip with a muscle-bound, tattooed-up narcissist.
Is this Moana?
Yes, this is Moana. And Aditya has completed a very successful set of misleading movie descriptions. Let me just give the disclaimer again. Most of these are not my creation. I have borrowed and adapted and added my own spin to a lot of descriptions I've gotten from the internet. This is a very popular thing with a lot. Hundreds more of these kind of descriptions are available online. You just have to search for them. I don't own any of this, so don't, you know, message us saying that you got that from this website on this forum. I know, I did get it from that website on that forum. So, Aditya.
Honestly, do message us, please. I love receiving messages, even if there's some hate mail, I like it.
Yeah.
I think no publicity is worse than bad publicity. So, yeah, hit us up.
No, tell us how much you suck. I don't think that's how it goes. I don't think that's how it goes.
We make something up.
Yes, definitely. So Aditya, what's your question to keep our audience on tenterhooks until next week? Or should I say meat hooks?
So my question is a reference to Vineet's question about how a Hollywood Walk of Fame star, the only one to be placed not on the flat surface, but instead on a vertical surface, is that of Muhammad Ali's. My question is, if there ever was to be a Hollywood Walk of Fame star, which would be on the roof, which particular star would that be? Instead of the floor, instead of the wall, it would be on the roof. What star would that be? And the answer will be revealed in next week's episode.
Yes. Hang on, more meat hooks till then. So before we end the episode definitively, there's the matter of the audience question. So the audience question for this week was as follows. For this week's episode was as follows. A Chinese gooseberry is the edible berry of several species of woody pines in the genus Actinidia. It is native to Central and Eastern Asia. The first recorded description dating back to the 12th century during the Song Dynasty. In the early 20th century, cultivation of the Chinese gooseberry spread to another nation, which gave it a name from its own indigenous language, the name by which we know it today. It soon became popular with Allied servicemen stationed in the country during World War II, which soon led to increased demand after the war and consequently its cultivation all across the world. How do we better know the Chinese gooseberry? Aditya, I can see from your face that you probably know this question and the answer. So, do you want to tell our audience what the answer is?
I believe the answer is kiwi.
Yes, it is the kiwi fruit. The kiwi fruit is originally from China and it was called initially the Chinese gooseberry. Cultivation of it in New Zealand led to it being given the name the kiwi fruit from its own indigenous Maori language. Allied forces, who were stationed in New Zealand, grew quite fond of the fruit, and when they went back to their respective homes after the war, there was a demand for this fruit, and soon it was cultivated in many parts of the world. And now it's quite ubiquitous. You get it in most countries, either grown there or imported. So that's the end of today's episode. Thank you for listening in. We hope you enjoyed the show and you learned something new. If you liked what you heard, please consider subscribing to our podcast and leaving us a review on your favorite podcast platform, wherever you're listening to us right now. It helps us reach a wider audience and allows more people to discover and enjoy the show. We would also love to hear from you. Feedback, suggestions, trivia, questions like Aditya got today from Anirudh. Thank you, Anirudh, again. You can send it to our personal Instagram accounts or to our account on Instagram at RUQuizzingMe. We appreciate your support and look forward to sharing more episodes with you in the future. Aditya, our fact checker general, will be back with the fact check after the musical sting. So that's all from me for today's episode.
See you guys next week.
Bye-bye.